Y'all, welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. This is Kevin Russell from Shiny Ribs in the Gorge right here in Austin, Texas. Jerry Jones, Lance Armstrong, and David Dewhurst walk into a bar. And honestly, who could blame them? Ladies and gentlemen, your host for the Tribcast, Mr. Reeve Hamilton. What'll it be, Reeve?
Yeah, boy.
Thank you to Kevin Shiny Ribs Russell for that intro. This is Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second or third week in January. All I know is that it's the first Tribcast since the start of the legislative session, which is very exciting.
And your calendar's already upside down, huh?
Yeah.
He's so starstruck he can't remember.
Well, that's what Evan Smith sounds like if you slow it down to one-third speed.
That's right.
Is that right? Like I've been drinking cough syrup?
Well, he does have that New York accent. I don't know if you could
What's
sense
the name
it.
Of that rap singer who died from the cough syrup in Houston?
You're All Alone.
Am I All Alone? What's the name of that?
No, DJ, that was his name.
DJ Screw.
DJ Screw. Coffee Cough.
Shut up, Ben. We should have gotten DJ Screw to do an intro. Build a time machine, go back 15 years, and get DJ Screw to do a really slow intro.
Hey, Mr. Moderator, this is already out of control.
What? That's because we have...
Have you even introduced people?
I'm not going to introduce people.
Hey, Reeve.
No one worthwhile is here.
Howdy. Ross says howdy.
CEO and Editor-in-Chief, Evan Smith.
Hey, how's it going?
Executive Editor, Ross Ramsey.
Howdy.
And Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Roll Tide.
All right, now that you've wasted our time with that sports reference.
Crap, that wasn't even a game. You should be ashamed.
I feel so bad for the quarterback's
Catholics
girlfriend.
Everywhere.
For Catholics everywhere.
We need to move on to the big sporting event at hand.
You are the Brent Musburger of the legislature.
I don't know what that means.
It's not good.
The legislative session. Let's go back to Monday where we got our revenue estimate before we entered this new era of being in session. How much money do we have?
We need that sound of clouds parting and angels singing.
Yeah, you know? Of course, the Tribcast has no money, but how much money does the state have?
It has a lot. In fact, the sort of one of the takeaways from this was when we were here 2 years ago going into a session and saying the state doesn't have any money, that turns out to be wrong. The state had a bunch of money, and they wrote a budget that was tight because they thought they needed to and also because they were conservative and that's what they wanted to do. Now they come back and the controller says, you have $8.8 billion
left. Why should we believe her now?
And then she says, you've got something approaching $12 billion in the rainy day fund, and revenue looks great. It's going to have, I don't have it in front of me, but you're going to have $105 or $108 billion available for general spending over the next 2 years. So the question is, kind of to Evan's point, if 2 years ago this was awful and the legislature reacted to it by writing a really tight budget, and she comes back and says everything's rosy, and the governor and some others are already talking about giving tax relief and doing all kinds of things with this money, at the same time they're talking about the volatility of the state economy and these estimates and everything, it sort of makes you wary of betting on these numbers.
And what does it mean for Susan Combs that she can't even give good news without getting a lot of sort of questionable press?
Well, I mean, it's a bad day when you have really great news and you come out and everybody says, well, wait a minute, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Well, so there's two problems here. One is that do we trust the comptroller's revenue estimate given the fact that it was so far off the last time? The second is that even if you trust the comptroller's revenue estimate and it's where she says it is, do we actually have as much money as everybody says we do? Should we be jumping up and down in the streets and talking about giving money back to people and tax cuts?
Right.
Do we actually have enough money to do the business of the state? This is an email I got from Scott McCown at CPPP, no one's idea of a conservative, let's stipulate.
Right.
But he wrote to me this morning, the way I see it is the comptroller's revenue estimate gives the ledge $92.6 billion to spend in the next 2 years, plus another $8.8 billion unanticipated from the current two-year cycle for a total of $101.4 billion. Right. To restore spending to pre-recession levels, which covers population growth and inflation, we need at least $108 billion. To do that and cover the Medicaid shortfall, we need at least $113 billion. To do that without accounting tricks, we need at least $115 billion. His point is, why are we talking about tax cuts? We're still $1 billion short from funding the priorities of the state. Now, many people, having said that, will take issue with Scott McCown's view of the world.
But
on the other hand, his point is at least one worth discussing.
I think where you see the governor and the lieutenant governor and the speaker on the first couple of days talking about getting rid of the accounting tricks that Scott McCown used in that email. That right there is a $5 billion number. And so that's $5 billion that the state is putting somewhere else that they want to move back to the purpose it's supposed to be collected for. And then they have to find $5 billion to fill that hole. And that's just to like true up the budget. And then you
forget about the investment spending on
right,
things like water and roads and all the stuff that going forward.
Well, and two caveats in the controller's numbers. Caveat number one is she said you have $8.8 billion left. That does not take into account anything that the legislature might use for a supplemental appropriations bill. So take from $8.8 billion, subtract $4.7 billion for Medicaid and whatever the legislature decides to put back into the current budget for education and any of the other cuts that they're talking about.
That school fund payment delay.
Well, so any
$2 billion?
Anything that they do, right? The school fund, you know, the foundation school payment, all of those things. So the supplemental bill, you know, in some conversations could be $8 billion. Some conversations it's closer to six. Some conversations it's closer to five. Whatever that is, it comes out of the $8.8 billion. So that gets subtracted. And the rainy day budget, rainy day fund number that she's projecting assumes that a certain amount of money from this budget will be left over and will roll into the rainy day fund. So when the House and the Senate write a supplemental appropriations bill here in the first 2 months of this session to cover holes in the current budget, that'll get subtracted from her numbers. That said, it's still a pretty fat set of numbers.
Well, it's hard to argue that that much money is worse than the situation last time. It's just a question of whether the optimism to the point of people talking about giving tax cuts is merited given the situation.
Well, it turned out 2 years ago that the pessimism from that estimate was probably misplaced. And so you look at this one and you say, well, if that one was wrong, why are we trusting this one?
Does a fat number mean a less contentious session, or is now we have people fighting over stuff instead of fighting to keep what they have?
Well, I think ordinarily they'd fight over stuff. I mean, you know, it's that thing where they come in and all the supplicants say, you have the money, spend it on us. But the legislature is also looking at the school finance lawsuit and saying the courts may drop a really big bill on us after the Supreme Court's through with school finance, you know, sometime next summer is what the presumption is. So let's hold some money back against that. That gives them a reason to say, let's don't spend money on whatever your darling project is.
And that's what David Dewhurst said as he ended the press conference that happened on Wednesday of this week with the big three, Strauss, Dewhurst, and Perry. Said, you know, because a lot of the questions are, so now you've got this money, are you going to restore the cuts made to public education in the last session? And his answer today was, well, not only, you know, yes, we're going to increase funding to schools, which doesn't necessarily restore cuts. But yes, we're going to increase funding to schools. But, you know, we just shouldn't get into this debate about what that magic number should be, because we're going to have courts tell us a number and then we'll fund it. And so my favorite part of that was that then off mic, Governor Perry very quickly said, maybe.
So Ross's column of last weekend that said basically that the school finance lawsuit is a great big, hairy, honking out.
Right.
For the legislature to
is
not
that what
do
I wrote?
Anything.
I couldn't remember. Yeah.
I think I was wondering
how that was going to end.
I may have augmented
and hardly get that kind of thing in the New York Times.
I don't think
anymore,
the Times would allow Harry as an adjective. I think they would have to call it Mr. Harry is right. What it is. The issue here is that the legislature, if it wants an out,
right,
has one in the form of the school finance lawsuit, they can go, well, we can't spend money on anything because we just don't know. We just don't know, blah, blah, blah.
They're trying to have it both ways, though, you know, because in the same press conference where they said we shouldn't, you know, go spending all this money because we don't have all this money to spend, they also said let's go spend all this money on tax relief.
Right.
Right. It's like we're going to get in front of all the other supplicants. We're the head supplicants in charge here. So I think there's going to be some pressure to spend some of this money, but I do think it's going to be, you know,
it seems governed by the
school finance.
It seems like they can't do both. They can't pay for the infrastructure that we have not paid for over the last couple of budgets, mm-hmm. Like funding, you know, Speaker Strauss in his opening day speech said that, you know, a 50-year water plan without a funding mechanism is no plan at all. So, you know, at least Speaker Strauss wants to start funding some of these things that have been left on the side for the last couple of sessions. Well, if you're going to do that and at least, you know, keep up with population and inflation on school stuff, you know, where's the money left over to send a check back to businesses for their franchise tax?
And so at this press conference that you went to on Wednesday morning,
which was really this morning.
We're pretending.
Which was the first appearance of the big three, right? The lieutenant governor, the speaker, and the governor since the start of the session. Was there anything substantive other than that we may or may not pay for schools once the courts tell us what to do?
Perry gave a very vigorous defense of public education. He said, there was a question about, you know, are you going to put the money back into public education that you guys cut 2 years ago? And Perry jumped in and said, you know, we've put a lot of money in public education over these last decade. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but he said, we put a lot of money back into public education. We have a great public education system. I don't think, you know, we have anything to apologize for.
We've also put a lot of students into public education.
Well, you know, and one of the, you know, and this is probably some number that, you got to go and look up the number, but he essentially said, look, over the last 10 years, our school budget has grown by 70%, but population in the school systems has only grown by 23%. So obviously, we're not underfunding anybody. That was his response today.
His argument was that increases in funding for education have outpaced both inflation and population.
And what about emergency items? Do we get any of those yet?
He said, we'll see. I mean, I think, you know, it looks like we're not going to have any big, gigantic emergency item that absolutely the Republican Party feels needs to be passed like we did last session with voter ID, because the Senate is going to have come up with their rules before he's created any emergency items, which means that they're going to not try to bypass the two-thirds rule.
Well,
like
in fact,
they
approved the two-thirds rule without discussion this morning. It's done. So
I mean, you know, he said that he might have some emergency items, and if they're necessary, he would do them in about a month once the House is organized, once the House has committees and committee chairs and everything. But it doesn't appear that there's going to be anything that is a must-pass like voter ID.
I continue to think that the voucher legislation in some fashion or form will find its way into the governor's line of sight on this.
So early voting in a Houston election to replace Mario Gallegos in the Senate started on Wednesday of this week, today, and as we tape this. And
this
so,
is the race in which the Houston Chronicle endorsed two candidates, although only one can win.
So the prospect on vouchers is that, you know, one of the arguments on vouchers is that they would like to get the school choice bill, whether it has vouchers in it or not, they'd like to get the school choice bill through the Senate or into the Senate before that last probably Democratic vote is added to the Senate. So, you know, that's the two timelines that are racing here.
So that could be as late as March, right?
There are eight candidates in that race, and, you know, there's probably going to be a runoff. So that delays it another month. But, you know, some of the advocates for that thing say, you know, this is going to be a tight vote anyway. Let's don't add another Democrat to the mix. Let's get this out of here. And the only way they could actually do that is if the governor came in and blessed it by calling it an emergency item.
Well, for instance, I actually expect that the likely winner of that race, whether it's Alvarado or Garcia, is likely not to be disposed favorably to vouchers.
That's the assumption that the supporters of the school choice stuff seem to be making.
Or if it's one of the other eight candidates, what, you don't expect that
to happen? Well, R.W. Bray may be for vouchers. I'm not sure that
he's the only Republican in the race, I think, right? We've got an independent, a green, and a mess of Democrats.
So, Evan, were you surprised that they kept the two-thirds rule without much discussion?
No, because I think that there were some who believed it should go down. I think Dan Patrick was the principal architect of this idea that it go down to 19. But no, I don't think so. I mean, I think it's the same thing as the discussion of the filibuster rule that the Democrats are trying to push in the U.S. Senate. You know, you don't like the rule when the weight of the majority is not in your hands. But then when you get back to the majority, suddenly the thing that you hated back then now looks a lot better. Well, and I think that for the Democrats to orchestrate in the U.S. Senate some overturning of the filibuster because they're in the majority, well, wait till the shoe's on the other foot, as it might well be sometime. And it's the same here. I think if the Republicans vote to undo the two-thirds rule, they may live to regret that here.
At least with the two-thirds rule, you actually have to get two-thirds, unlike filibustering where you don't actually have to filibuster.
Right.
Right. You can just threaten a filibuster. Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, most of the individual power of Texas senators comes from the two-thirds rule. If you were in a caucus system, the caucus would decide and people would go talk to the chairman of the caucus and try to settle their issues there. In a legislative body with something like the two-thirds rule, they have to go to every single senator because that may be, depending on which side you're on, the 11th senator or the 21st.
Right.
And it gives them individual power. And like you say, I mean, some issues, this is a partisan matter. On a lot of issues, it's not partisan at all.
Well, you know,
how the Senate's
the old joke, unfair to him, let me acknowledge up front, was that the Republicans don't need two-thirds. They've got 19 plus Eddie Lucio or something like that. You know, there was always a joke that Lucio was always the Republicans' extra vote, you know, right there. Not fair to him, but that was always the idea. And I think that the point...
You can just sense Evan's regret in telling this.
No, I'm not regretting telling it, but I also think it's unfair to
Senator
him.
Senator on line one.
And I frankly think... I'll give my cell phone number. He can call me and complain about this personally. The point is that it really isn't Lucio so much as that on any given issue, there's a potentially a Democrat to be picked off.
You can find one.
If you need to.
Well, and the fact that those people come to you and are asking for your vote is what makes you powerful in the Senate.
In fact, you need two, because until Gallegos's replacement is set. Yeah, right.
Right. Okay. So, that was. But the fact that they have to come to you and ask you for your vote is what makes you powerful as a senator. In a caucus system, they don't have to come to you; they just go to the caucus leader.
What do you think about Joan Huffman chairing the Republican caucus in the Senate this time?
Well, I mean, they're changing. It's changing hands. The mantle passes. Tommy Williams is now chairman of finance. Other people have sort of moved into other leadership positions, over the years.
My question is, does she set up as a dynamic and aggressive caucus chair, given the fact that the Republican caucus can play a disproportionately large role if it wishes to in the Senate?
Do they really need a dynamic and aggressive caucus chair?
I don't think that caucus follows a given leader on everything. I think they come in and, it's a relatively small group, and they're surprisingly opinionated, and I think they just jump in.
Does she reflect the ideological makeup of the Senate fairly accurately? Is she the kind of the center point of the people to her left and people to her right?
I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to go back to the Mark Rice charts charts from Rice.
That the Tea Party caucus in the Senate, formal or informal, has expanded pretty significantly its numbers with the addition of Campbell and Paxton and Hancock and Schwertner.
And Taylor, right.
Is the
the Duncan and L-type wing and the Corona wing of the party is probably a bit more on the fringe than it's been in the past.
Is the thinking of a caucus chair that they are the midpoint ideologically?
Well, not necessarily. I'm just wondering where she is.
Someone that needs a seniority position somewhere.
I don't have the
sense
that this is, because it's not a caucus system, I don't have the sense that this isn't the equivalent of a McConnell or a Reid in the U.S. Congress. I think that this is basically just, you call the meetings and organize this stuff and we'll go in there and argue against each other.
Well, let's move
make sure
over
they
to
get
the
donuts.
Right.
Move over to the
move
house.
Over to the House, where we won't know who the caucus chairs are for another week or so.
Well, it's Creighton
and Murphy in the House on the Republican side, and it looks like Farrar is willing to move aside.
There's some. Do you hear Wally's name?
Wally's name, but he doesn't. It's not a challenge situation. It doesn't sound like it. May be one of those things where she says, it's time. Me to move on.
Step off, and then
right.
Of course, I wonder why hadn't TMF been.
Well, they've
acting as a caucus of one.
Well, that's the Mexican American Legislative Caucus, right? Yeah. So there are a bunch of caucuses, and
I just wonder why Trey doesn't formalize the role he wishes to play clearly and just run for caucus chair.
Right.
Maybe he likes being the not having his own sort of outsider kind of thing.
In some ways, the substantive caucus on the Democrat side is the Legislative Study Group. They come out with every piece of legislation. Here's what this looks like. Here's how this cuts. That's the thing that's influential on the floor. They actually do their homework, so it's not purely political.
Well, and while we're talking about the House, maybe we should back up and talk about the Speaker's race that wasn't.
Be a short conversation.
What is the calculation that David Simpson made in deciding not to put it to a vote?
I think he couldn't get past two hands on the number of people that were going to vote for.
That was the case last year. And
this looked like a Frank Capra movie that came apart. I think there was some imaginary version of I'm going to come out and give a big sweeping speech and all this stuff is going to fall into place and everybody will see the wonderful logic of it and they'll jump to my side. And it doesn't work like that. Strauss consolidated his vote. Strauss went through the last election in 2011 and they called for an acclamation vote and somebody objected and he got in with 18 members in some way or another.
I thought it was 15.
There's 15 no's, there were two abstentions and there was one absent.
Okay.
So 18 members didn't vote for Strauss.
And Jason Isaac, who was one of the white lights on that, seconded the nomination.
And that's to my point. Strauss went...
You know what day that was determined? 2 years ago,
Strauss went out
to the day.
Strauss went out and got to work and started, doing what you do. He did his politics. There's some griping that he went out and bought off these votes. He didn't go out and buy off these votes. He went out and coaxed these people back in. That's how legislative politics works. And when he got to the floor, he had all the votes he needed. Simpson didn't have any votes. And in fact, Simpson had some of the people that were behind him saying, we're going to get killed on this thing. There's no reason for us to go over the wall. This isn't Gallipoli. This is the Texas House, and we're going to have to live here for 140 days.
And the question is whether the speaker is in a vengeful mood and he appoints everybody who was publicly against him, Zedler and
I think if the speaker had
the
been
committee
in a
on gross screw yourself.
I think if the speaker had been in a vengeful mood, he would have forced a vote to make the no's show themselves.
To publicly reveal their stigmata.
I think there were probably some people in his camp who were begging him to do that. But he sort of said, let's just do this by voice vote acclamation. Bada bing, bada boom, let's move on.
Is that significant now that no one has to be the no vote on Strauss? Other than Simpson's speech was not, non-combative. He was still out there saying that, the speaker is,
but he was all alone. Nobody was standing up there with him. I mean, it was all alone. It was one guy, it's like, okay, thank you, move along. It was, it really was one of those, it set up
but
as
again,
no story.
But again, you had Zedler and you had... Matt Krause.
And you had Hughes. Matt Krause sent out a message that said, sent out a message to his folks that said, if Simpson had stood for a vote, I would have voted for him.
Right. Well, you have people who've basically put themselves oppositional to the speaker in this case, right? That's it.
But, I don't,
Who would have predicted a year ago that John Boehner would have narrowly escaped, but that Joe Strauss would have raced past any credible threat to be reelected speaker? I mean, that's interesting.
Well,
that Boehner was in greater peril than... Right.
It's not even really John Boehner. I mean, would you have predicted that of all the big three, Joe Strauss is the one that's coming into the session with sort of riding a high point?
Stop reading Burke's blog.
This is a completely half-baked theory, but I think there is an urge in Austin to run away from anything that looks like Washington. And I think that there was, some sense in the legislature yesterday and these first couple of days of don't do anything that looks like Washington. Don't do anything that looks like Boehner. Don't do anything that looks like caucuses in the Senate.
The tanning salons are going to hate this.
Look, this is not a knock on the speaker or comment on the speaker personally.
Sounds like it's going to be a knock on the speaker, doesn't it?
Let me talk about Lucio. Again.
Speaker Strauss and Senator Lucio are welcome to come anytime.
Brought to you by.
But how solid is he? Actually, what Reeves' point is, it looks like of the he's the one
that's about as well as
I actually think that the speaker did right by himself in the course of the speaker's race, conducted it with dignity, got through fine, he's now speaker. But the embedded challenges that he faced from a leadership standpoint prior to the speaker's race have not been eliminated by the end of the speaker's
race. It's going to be very quiet for a couple of 3 weeks because he hasn't named his committees yet.
Right.
Last time, I think they waited till February 9th. I looked up the other day. So he's going to, in the next couple of weeks, name his committees, and that's going to create, absent everything else, that's going to create a set of winners and losers, right? And then we'll proceed to the next fight from there. But
And he'll still have a chance to, all the big three were standing together today and, holding hands in their big press conference today, but he still has an opportunity to, show that his priorities, the top items on his list, don't necessarily match up with the lieutenant governor and the governor. Yesterday he was kind of pushed on the idea of are some of these socially conservative things that you are interested in pushing in the House, and he said, I am interested in pushing water, education, state infrastructure.
And he was pretty down on standardized testing in his speech, wasn't he?
Well, but he did, but
don't misunderstand. I mean, I think you're correct to highlight that. Mm-hmm. That I thought was of all the things he said yesterday, that was the thing that jumped out at me. He is putting himself on the other side of that issue from the education commissioner and the governor. Now, he may be with the 90-odd percent of school boards who've passed resolutions against testing representing 90-odd percent of students in the state. But there is something to him putting himself out there as a significant thing.
Even Michael Williams and Rick Perry stepped away from that, though. I mean, they backed off very quickly after this last election from that 15% requirement.
Right. Well, and didn't Perry said something about, don't be ready to raid the rainy day fund? And I think Strauss in his press conference – on the first day, was like, well, I'm not up for raiding anything, but I think we should take a responsible look at this stuff.
Right, he said, it's using the rainy day fund is not the same as raiding the rainy day fund, is I think how the way he put it.
Hmm. I thought it was interesting that Perry, if I'm correct about this, that did Perry in his speech to the Senate did not mention vouchers.
Was it the other way around? Was it the House?
Or
they
the didn't? Well, I thought he.
I don't think he mentioned it in the House.
I don't think he mentioned. I don't think he mentioned.
He didn't mention it in the House. I wasn't in the Senate.
I think he didn't mention it at all.
Well, you know,
I think in the Senate he did.
It's not a voucher bill, Evan. Come on.
My recollection is that he didn't, but let me go back and look at it.
All I know is that that woman fainted.
That's right.
He had a good Donna line. Campbell, he got out a good line.
He got out. He got off a good line, and Donna Campbell and the other docs got in there, and right.
Yep.
Yeah, and she survived.
So Campbell and Schwertner and Duell run over, and if you don't need an eyeball or a hip, that leaves Duell, I guess, right?
Isn't one of them a large animal vet? No.
So
Campbell's probably the most qualified. She's an ER doctor, right?
Yeah, well, she's an eye doctor.
And what would the comment? What she's an ER? She's an ER doctor.
If your eye goes out, she's an ER.
But the comment was that she got through the crowd and to the person very quickly. In the manner of an ER doctor who understands that E stands for emergency, right?
She leapt over Whitmire, didn't she? And just vaulted.
Vaulted Whitmire in a single
knocked
bound.
Knocked all his hair off.
So you were surprised that Perry didn't...
That's three calls for Evan Smith.
You were surprised that Perry didn't mention vouchers just because you think it's high on his priority list.
Well, I think, somebody, Rick, your friend at the Chronicle.
Dunham.
Commented about all the things that Perry didn't say during the speech. And it was cast in the vein of, well, is he running for office again nationally or not?
State of the state speeches.
Didn't mention the 10th Amendment, right. Didn't mention Barack Obama, all these things. It was a little bit more jocular.
Yeah, they felt very casual. The one in the House, I did not see the one in the Senate. I was in the House, and it was very, people were like, oh, well, I hear he made a big deal about abortion. I was like, well, if by big deal you mean it was one of the 10 things he mentioned.
It isn't a big deal, but he says it every time he's out. He's been talking about this a lot.
But it was 18 seconds. I mean, yeah.
It wasn't a shock that he talked about it, right?
He did some pre-session interviews. Not much news came out of those. He's going to have his State of the State speech a couple of days after the inauguration. Isn't the inauguration the 21st?
Yes.
Something like that. I think the State of the State's, somewhere in the 22nd or 23rd time frame. That's when a governor generally says, here are some things I'd like to do this session. So, if he's going to make any news, he'll probably make it there. If he's going to declare any emergency items, which looks iffy, but if he's going to declare any,
you really think it's iffy whether he declares?
I think he will declare a couple because you got 60 days when they can't do anything else. It's a layup.
It's a way to get them focused on your agenda.
I think you have a point about school choice. I think the fetal pain thing, if he's going to make a big deal out of that, I think that's a possible item.
I think that the fetal pain thing sets up almost more than vouchers as a natural emergency item for him. Because he has the votes.
But he's not making news now because he's going to make news then. And if you make a bunch of news now and you get the wagon rolling and then everybody's political attention shifts in a week or so to the inauguration and all of that stuff, then you've lost your momentum. So wait till after that, grab the momentum back and get the session going. And I he'll do his State of the State. They'll announce committees somewhere in the 2 weeks after that. He'll either have or not have his emergency items, and we'll be off to the races.
Do you think one of the emergency items will be declaring Johnny Football to be the greatest Texan alive? It's a question. I don't know.
This is the time of resolutions,
we're
right?
When they're not
doing anything substantive, this is when they do, Tyler's Roses and all of that stuff. I think Johnny Manziel will be down here probably a couple of times.
The Little League in Big Spring, we're going to get them all out on the field.
He gave Rick Santorum a Texas A&M, I guess his son Griffin gave Rick Santorum a sweater vest. Texas A&M.
Oh, yeah, Santorum was at the opening day.
Right,
a big thrill for everyone.
What's he running for?
Senator Paxton is his pal.
Yeah. He did a thing for Senator Paxton. He's raising some money.
We had Santorum lined up for the intro this week, but we decided to have Kevin Russell from the Gourds instead.
There you go.
Really, pretty hip swap out there. Reeve.
Yeah, I know. Are we done?
Wear a sweater vest.
Would you say this is more or less substantive than the opening day of the legislative session?
It was at least as substantive as the opening day of the session.
Yeah.
Is that what he said?
No, that's what I said.
Oh, that's what you said.
Okay, well then, on behalf of Evan, Ben, Ross, our producer Todd, and anyone that emails questions and comments to tribcast@texastribune.org, this is Reeve. Thanks for listening.
Hey, y'all. Welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. I'm Kevin Russell from Shiny Ribs and the Gourds. Tom Landry used to always say that football is to Texas what religion is to a priest. And I can only conclude from those thoughts that Jerry Jones and the Dallas Cowboys have become a bunch of deicidal maniacs. And speaking of deicidal maniacs, ladies and gentlemen, here's your host of the Tribcast, Mr. Reeve Hamilton. Take it, Reeve.